They're also extremely difficult to obscure and trace the bulk imprint of matter motions from most energetic processes in the universe. Now, everything, since there's only one sun of charge, everything makes gravitational waves. I'm hand waving right now, and in fact, I'm emitting a very small amount of gravitational waves. So gravitational waves are produced over a wide range of length and timescales, notably the Big Bang, for those of you here who are interested in cosmology. I know there's another workshop going on. But everyone in this room, I think, is primarily interested in smaller, more compact objects whose natural length and timescales correspond to the size of ground-based gravitational wave detectors, such as LIGO, GEO, Virgo, TAMA, so on and so forth. So that's what I'm going to focus on here. So if you're going to take anything away from this talk, you should take away and understand the impact of this slide. Nature has provided us with the perfect collider for hypermassive nuclei for neutron stars. The perfect collider. It has roughly a constant energy. We have a very high luminosity, to use a collider analogy, integrating over back to arbitrarily high redshift. We have a large number of events. We may not be able to see very many of them because our detectors currently aren't sufficiently sensitive, but there's a large number of these events going on. And their gravitational wave signature and their electromagnetic signature carries unique and complementary information about what has gone on. The gravitational waves, as you all know, carry the imprint of basically all matter motion in some way or another, possibly not very large, but in many cases quite significant. And as we've seen previously in several talks, electromagnetic signatures coming from before the merger, during the merger, and after the merger, sometimes even long after the merger, can tell us additional information that might be difficult to get out because it involves a small amount of matter, the cracking of the crust, ejected tidal tail, but which provides important information about, for example, the neutron star crust, or in the case of ejected material, possibly the equation of state and the compactness of neutron stars. And while it's roughly monochromatic in energy, we're basically spiraling in a circular orbit until they finally merge. I'm going to ignore eccentricity for this talk. We still have a number of knobs we can turn. Not all black holes are likely to be identical. Not all neutron stars are likely to be identical. Black holes in particular will have different masses and spins, and spin orientations relative to the neutron star. Therefore, you can imagine basically taking a neutron star, putting a black hole next to it, and moving it in and twisting it around relative to your neutron star. That is an incredibly controlled experiment that I know that Jocelyn will comment on briefly in her talk after lunch. So we have a unique opportunity to basically perform controlled experiments with nuclear matter. This opportunity should not be and will not be wasted. Now, for those of you who know something about compact object merger rates, I want to comment briefly on this number. So ideally, you will have infinitely sensitive detectors that detect all gravitational wave sources that are available to us, or at least available to us in the mass range to which we're sensitive. And if we do that and we see out arbitrarily far in the universe, eventually we see so far that we run out of stars, and we see back to the Big Bang, since there's no star-forming gas there. So the plot, you can't read the x's at all on that. So this plot over here is a plot of the star formation history of the universe. You can't have mergers if you don't have stars. You don't have compact objects. Well, ignoring primordial black holes, but those don't involve nuclear matter, so we're not going to go there. Therefore, as a result, if you look back arbitrarily far on the plot on the right, to your right, this is a plot of the merger rate per unit redshift as a function of the log of the redshift. And you can see that since this is per redshift bin, there can be very large numbers of events just of double neutron stars, not including all the other scenarios, and this is just including field binary evolution according to fairly prosaic models of how stars evolve. It's possible this number could be higher for a number of reasons. So, ideally, eventually, and by eventually I mean of order 20-ish years when they get third generation detectors built, possibly sooner if we detect something soon, and all of you get behind the effort and encourage it to be built sooner rather than later, we'll have a collider luminosity of hundreds of thousands to millions of events per year. So you can go back and sit and think, well, if I had a million events per year, what could I do? Neutron star mass distributions, for example. That's easy. But you can also do all of these fun tidal disruption things because you'll have huge numbers of events and be able to measure these distributions very reliably. This will tell you something, for example, about how supernova work from, for example, both the neutron star and the black hole mass distributions. And that's just the most obvious thing that you can think of. There are also, over cosmic time, the nature of star formation changes, it's very likely that you'll be able to correlate this with these the processes that go into star formation. Even without a host galaxy, for example, you'll be able to see how star formation changing with metallicity impacts the progenitor star and eventually the compact object. Finally, with 10 to the 5 sources per year, and of course, the assumption is if you have a detector sensitive to get this, it's really darn sensitive. So if once you reach the sensitivity, and this gray bar right there is roughly the Einstein telescope design sensitivity cutoff, and you have 10 to the 5 sources a year, in order to reach that point, you have to have a sensitive detector. So a few of the things that you see, the sources of things, the type of sources that to which LIGO is sensitive right now, are really, really strong. So you can extract a lot of information from them. What type of information? Well, that's something that Matt has talked about previously. Jocelyn will talk about in the future. Basically, the imprint of all those wonderful processes that you were describing and that Jocelyn will describe, all those controlled distortions and tidal disruptions will carry some imprint or another on the gravitational wave signature. The typical problem, though, is that most of these things occur, the things that you're most interested in, at high frequencies, to which ground-based detectors, by typical design, are not exceptionally sensitive. We're actually exceptionally sensitive to the things that happen right before the collision, and to a lesser extent during. So it really helps to have a slightly more sensitive detector than a default advanced LIGO design. So to emphasize this point, what is the thing to which we are sensitive? So this is a movie that Harold and the gang put together. So what happens in a binarian spiral? Well, you have two compact objects. They're spiraling around. They go through a sequence of quasi-circular orbits. They spiral faster and get closer until eventually they merge, go through a complex nonlinear phase, and ring down to a final compact object. In this case, a double black hole. And as a result, you can map that in the bottom of the movie. There's a nice time sequence. You can see that there's a frequency that's gradually increasing because you're getting closer. And as you get closer and move faster, your gravitational wave strain gets higher. So you typically get a signal that sounds like and some fun stuff that happens at the end. Ground-based gravitational wave detectors for typical masses are sensitive to this, primarily sensitive to this inspiraling part, for those of you who are interested in nuclear matter and for typical masses and spins. If you have just this inspiral part, you can measure this chirp rate very accurately, which will tell you something about the masses of the objects. Additionally, however, particularly in the case of black holes, although possibly not exclusively, there can be spin-orbit coupling. You all know spin-orbit coupling. It's a total angular momentum. My orbital angular momentum moves around it. Now, gravitational waves are primarily propagated, if you have a particle going around a circle, perpendicular to the orbital plane. So that's the little donut or peanut up there. And you get something like a lighthouse effect. Sometimes that beam is pointing towards you, sometimes away, leading to characteristic modulations in your signal. This is all in the epoch before merger. This is cut off as a function of time. And these modulations allow you to identify not only the mass, but also critically the spin. And as Matt kindly pointed out in his talk, the nature of the collision process depends sensitively on the masses of the two objects, the spin of the black hole, and how the spin is oriented. So gravitational waves are a wonderful way of identifying the inputs to your nuclear matter collision. Also, additionally, for those of you who care, it tells you something about the fact that your spins were misaligned, for example, which would tell you something about how supernova work because it constrains the nature of supernova kicks, which would be of interest to those of you who do nuclear matter. Matt went into this in some detail, but yes, your collision process is, I think, what you guys most care about, the fact that there is tidal disruption. And as Matt went on at some length, the nature of the tidal disruption process changes if you change the mass of the two complex objects, the mass ratio, and the spin magnitude and the spin orientation. He had a wonderful figure. I'm not going to go back into it. As a result, and I don't think this is something he dwelled on, if you have tidal disruption at a different point, that's a different frequency, a different epoch in your wave. And that leads to a very distinctive termination, in some sense, if it's a black hole neutron star and it gets promptly absorbed, of your signal. Or not, if it's a double neutron star and it's a sloshing hypermassive remnant. So therefore, there is potentially information that you can get out from this tidal disruption phase, both from the simple fact that there is a tidal disruption and from sloshing. And there are people in the audience, and I know Jocelyn, who will be talking about this later. Also, of course, there are potentially, if you have a hypermassive remnant, you can possibly get distinctive signatures from the unstable eigenmodes. And there are some very recent papers that have come out with interesting results on that. What's also interesting is the fact that, and perhaps the most important from the gravitational wave science community, is the electromagnetic counterpart. It's possible to get out information from the gravitational wave signature on the nature of nuclear matter. That information is very limited and is tied to the bulk properties of motion. Gravitational waves carry the imprint of bulk motion. Often, some of the most interesting pieces of information that you can expect about nuclear matter are, for example, how much of a remnant disk is left over. And while gravitational waves can provide that information, particularly if the modes are strong, it's highly unstable, and there's a lot of mass left over, sometimes it might be easier to do if you look at the electromagnetic counterpart that you would expect by tearing this material apart. So gravitational waves will provide some information, but it's particularly important to have information that you get from electromagnetic signatures. Now, there have been several talks on how this works. But as the most prosaic example, of course, is the fact that when you rip apart a compact object, people believe that it's probably associated with and produces a gamma ray burst. There's a large amount of energy released by whatever magical mechanism you like, magnetic field, neutrino, antineutrino annihilation. It gets converted into a relativistically expanding blast wave, which unfortunately, as relativistically expanding fireballs tend to do, completely disguises the nature of the source. So the problem with short GRBs conventionally as a way of constraining the nature of the source and providing the sort of information that we want is that the fireball disguises it, unless you want to make certain types of interpretations about the extended emission, the prior emission, something that's not quite the conventional fireball-ish. You'll get a jet opening angle, and you'll get a total amount of power. But if you have, for example, these kilonova that were mentioned previously, if you have crust cracking, if you have energy reinjection, these can tell us something about what is actually going on. Which of these many channels, Matt had a more comprehensive diagram, is the predominant channel, and how do these signals connect to it? That's not visible at all. Okay. But these slides were actually were shown, and I think in two talks previously. For example, the amount of matter that you have will gradually, when you tidally disrupt the compact object, some material will fall back. And in Brian's talk yesterday, this sort of accreted material can provide an electromagnetic signature, which may or may not be affected by nuclear processes. So to summarize, what we have in gravitational wave astronomy is the interesting prospect of having the ability to measure the inputs of the collision and working with electromagnetic observations and models for the nature of nuclear matter and tidal disruption, possibly be able to simultaneously constrain some of the outputs of the collision, along with using gravitational wave measurements to constrain the compressibility of nuclear matter through tidal distortion and disruption. So, for example, we'll be able to measure the inputs of masses, spins, spin orbit misalignments, We'll also get some information about, in some special cases, of what galaxy it came from. For example, if there was a gamma ray burst, we'll know where it came from. We'll know, by implication, something about the likely progenitors of it, the delay time, which we can use, again, to make inferences about the nature of the evolutionary processes, the likely stellar progenitors, which would then produce the compact objects in the cases where we can't get reliable mass measurements. This can be particularly important. And we'll also have measurements, hopefully, of the ejecta, which will give us clues about between the ejecta coming along a time later, and in some cases prompt emission, you'll get simultaneous constraints of the inputs, the amount of disk mass from the GRB power, and the amount of ejected mass, which would be exceptionally useful. And of course, we're going to be able to measure the neutron star mass distribution to exquisite precision very soon. So to summarize and to initiate some discussion, for binary compact evolution, what do we need from people who do nuclear matter? Well, it would be nice to have more nuclear equations of state. It would also be nice for people who are doing simulations to have, I know this is asking for something that all of you know would be useful, but for example, how to connect the black hole disk mass to the jet power. This will require a detailed emission model with whatever coupling mechanism that you have, but that is one of the primary electromagnetic observables. And if we're going to measure the inputs and someone gives us a jet power, we'll be able to say, okay, this is how much power came out, this is what the objects were that went in, but without one of those two other pieces of information, the ejected mass or some connection between the jet power and the inputs, we won't necessarily know how to interpret that as a constraint on nuclear matter. By implication, this means that, as was discussed previously, it's going to be important to have a very detailed understanding of how material is secreted onto the black hole, both promptly and at late times, which may be, for example, modified by our process heating. Now, I focused in this talk primarily on binaries because I think that's the simplest and most prototypical example, but there are certainly, for just the study of the gravitational waves from isolated neutron stars, similar significant and relatively dire needs. For those of you who are interested in, for example, oscillations of neutron stars, those are also at high frequency, but they may persist for a long time, or they may occur from sources in our galaxy, which are relatively close by. And we have a chance of seeing and significantly constraining those oscillations. And in fact, for those of you who've looked at the LIGO publication list, you've seen that we've already published several papers on those sorts of events. Unfortunately, we have done so in the absence of detailed models of how the energy is extracted and stored in the neutron star. So more work on energy extraction and flare models for isolated neutron stars would be exceptionally helpful. For those of you who are interested in pure nuclear physics, it is also very important to know if you have an isolated neutron star that's orbiting around, it'll have some distortions on it, left over from its formation process, earlier magnetic activity. How large are those distortions? We have an upper limit, we have some breaking strain, but not all distortions are going to take on the maximum value. And it's quite likely that some will take on a much lower value. And after a long period of time, so this is a plot of the characteristic age on the horizontal axis, and the upper limit on the largest distortion that you could have on the vertical axis, the black dots are currently existing observational limits. If it were smaller than that, it's possible, but anything larger than that is impossible because the spin down rate from gravitational waves would be faster than what is observed. And you can see that there's this big wide open space in the bottom where it's possible that pulsars could have ellipticities. Pulsars could have distortions. And this corresponds pretty much precisely to the sort of range, the upper limit of what you would expect from Chuck's calculations and reasonable estimates of the nuclear shear modulus. However, it's possible that most neutron stars, as they get old, and are hot and cooling down, flat, or are born flat. After all, look at the ones that are really old and have 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 meters. These are all recycled pulsars. We know these are flat because we can look at their spin down rate and we can see it's consistent with 10 to the minus 8. So if all neutron stars are born flat, then we're in big trouble. And so it is exceptionally important to have a good idea of what is the likely range of mountain heights. And finally, of course, for those of you who are interested in supernova, it'd be really nice to have a whole bunch of information about how supernova work, for example, how they impart kicks, how the supernova imparts spin into the neutron star, how hypercritical common envelope evolution works, how common envelope evolution works, because these provide the inputs that we use to figure out how often these things merge, and by implication, turning it around, when we see a distribution of compact objects, the inferences that we draw from it. So I think that's all. I know that a lot of other people in this room I've mentioned, so I'm hoping that this will be a good time to start discussion. Thanks.
Questions, discussion. So I've got one question. You've talked a lot about third generation detectors, but I guess the second generation detectors will go online. So can you comment on what is going to be happening and what we can expect to see with advanced LIGO?
What we can expect to see? do I have a rate plot in here? No, I don't think I have one on hidden slides. We will expect to see, at a minimum, and this is for double compact objects, double neutron stars, at least 10-ish per year, based on extrapolating from the Milky Way, more or less. You take the number of double pulsars you have in the Milky Way, you extrapolate to the universe, it's a reasonable density, you get a fairly large number. The number of black hole neutron star, emerging black hole neutron star binaries, well, we don't really know because there are none in the Milky Way. In fact, there are none that we know of. So the extrapolations there permit, in principle, significantly higher numbers. How high? Well, go to the current LIGO result page, take your favorite neutron star mass, take your favorite black hole mass, pick the corresponding bin, and that is what the upper limit is. I can come up with upper limits that are higher than that. So in principle, it could be tens per year, it could be hundreds per year of binary compact objects with nuclear matter. For binary compact objects with black holes, there are unusual, extra special things that happen, which potentially allow the merger rate to be even more, even higher. So for those of you who are interested in general relativity, thousands. Basically, the current upper limit is the upper limit. In principle, we could be higher than that. Yes, I know. Even higher than the currently existing upper limit does seem relatively excessive, but we can come up with reasonable predictions, basically having to do with the fact that there's a lot of star formation a long time ago. That star formation occurred with low metallicity. Those low metallicity stars preferentially form large compact objects, which black holes, and we can see those things are really darn far, far away. And so as a result, it's possible to get an extraordinarily large number of events. So for the science that you can do with advanced LIGO, there's a lot to be done with just binary black holes. But that's not of primary interest here.
Richard, you were talking about the mass distribution, being able to map out mass distributions with lots of detections. Are you aware of any studies? This may be the wrong talk, and Jocelyn's may be talking about this, but that look at the systematic error in mass.
Existing systematics for the mass distribution from like Jim
Lattimore's thought? From detection. So from parameter estimation with a gravitational waveform, you have this phase acceleration in the neutron star in spiral that that I assume parameter estimation codes have to be taking into account right now for LIGO.
So is your question how accurately can parameter estimation recover the tidal coupling, Or is your question, what is the mass distribution of neutron stars that you can extract from?
Yes, how I think it's the second. How accurately can parameter estimation recover the masses of these objects?
So for high mass ratio binaries, not very accurately, particularly when they're spin at the low SNRs that are likely for initial LIGO, unless you have things that break some degeneracy. Spin orbit coupling is really nice for, with modulation, is really nice for breaking some of the degeneracies because there's certain things that happen. So the neutron star mass, particularly given the typical uncertainties in post-Newtonian models that we've been typically using, that accuracy has been poor. So there's a significant systematic error, unpleasantly large systematic error, and there is an unpleasantly large error just because the small mass doesn't affect the phasing as dramatically as you would like. So I would prefer not to give a number off the top of my head. I have seen real parameter estimation studies that take both of those numbers into account, and I can't talk about them in this venue because it's secret inside of LIGO stuff. But I'm happy to give you references to studies that are outside of LIGO, Vendersloys et al., for example, with a spinning black hole neutron star binary. Yeah, it's extremely SNR dependent. It depends on how many harmonics you include. It depends on the mass ratio of the binary. It depends, unfortunately, on a lot of things. So the first few detections, not as accurately as you would like. You can probably tell the difference between a black hole neutron star and a black hole for the first few detections. That's why statistics really make a big difference. So once you get to, there's a big difference between one detection. So I have a study that one of these days I'm going to write up and publish. And there's a big difference between one event, 10 events, and 100 events in terms of your ability to estimate what distributions are, both because there's intrinsic difficulty in measuring mass ratio. So each event gives you So there's two issues. There's the intrinsic distribution, let's say, of black hole masses. So for the total mass or for black hole masses, because we can measure the chirp mass reliably, our measurement error is sometimes smaller than the distribution of black hole masses. So it doesn't really matter that there's any. So our error is not a problem. However, we can imagine reversing the situation where we have the distribution of neutron star masses, and this is our experimental error. This is the situation that we would be in under certain conditions that are not that unlikely for neutron stars. And in that case, having more measurements can help, but it also helps to have louder sources as well, and that's something that we get with time. It makes a big difference to have the few louder sources that you get, because those are much more reliably determined, particularly, again, if there's spin.
Could you just elaborate on the neutron star, neutron star?
The neutron star, neutron star?
Yeah, sure.
What would you like to know?
Oh, the mass.
Oh, the mass information. So neutron star in some ways are easier because they're symmetric. So, for example, the usual rule of thumb. One way to look at it is to look at what people in the field call the template bank number and the template bank density. Basically, how many models of signals do you need to use to find an object of that mass? And if you look at the way they're distributed, the density increases dramatically at low mass. So our ability to measure neutron star masses, because the total mass is lower and the signal is longer, is more precise. I don't have a number offhand, but I can give you one if you come up and I can dredge one out. But as I recall, you shouldn't have as much of a problem as long as the neutron stars are relatively different in mass. If you're talking about distinguishing a 1% mass difference, it's going to be a problem.
So maybe just a question from the simulation camp. You pointed out differences that arise when you change parameters like the spin, like the mass ratio, the direction of the spin, etc. Given that every time you do a non-vacuum simulation, you just do one simulation. We need to try to find out a preferred set of the parameter space to attack it. And I know I'm totally putting on the spot, but...
No, no, it's funny. No, that's fine, because I'm writing a paper on this very subject right now. So so it's possible to do this. It's possible to say where... I mean, in some ways, this is what the template bank problem. What is the space of signals that is minimal that you need? A lot of people have come up with different ways of addressing this problem. And this is probably not the audience to give citations and describe specific methods, but I'm sure you know the SVD stuff. So I can tell you the answer right now for high mass compact up for, you know, 100 solar mass. If you're interested in that range, that template bank is very easy. It's very sparse, and it's very easy to do. If you're interested in black hole neutron star simulations, I mean, you've seen the template banks as often as I have. Well, maybe not as often. You've seen them often. And from a gravitational wave perspective, when you get to very high mass ratio, your signal gets longer, and so you need more templates there. And that's it's unfortunate, but true. So what is the, is there something more concrete that you...
You're giving me an answer from a data analysis point of view, which is fine. You want to, from that point of view, you want to cover the parameter space in a good enough way. Now, I want the answer from your astrophysics cat feeling point of view.
Oh, my astrophysics
cat. Do you believe a 3-to-1 ratio? Of course not. Do you believe a non-spinning case? Of course not. So what, if you get your choice of running 3 simulations, 5 simulations, which would be the ones you would go for first?
I hate to give you a lame answer, but 10 to 1.4 is actually 5 to 1.4, 10 to 1.4, and 15 to 1.4. Because I can vary parameters all day. I can give you any mass distribution for black holes you want. Christian can probably refine that statement, but there's a wide range of ways you can tear mass on and off a star. And so I can come up with a mass distribution for black holes that peaks at different places for the merging black hole neutron star binaries. For double neutron star binaries, it's whatever mass distribution you know you want to draw out of your equation of state, and as long as you're believing a 2.5-ish, you know, mass ratio limit, there's a very narrow range. So I'm assuming you're focusing on the black hole case, and in that case, because there's such a variety of ways that you can modify compact objects through binary evolution, and because we know very little about the inputs to binary evolution, for example, supernova kicks, there's not so much we can do. So for most purposes, this is a good rule of thumb for the black hole mass distribution to use, and I would pick something here and here and here. If you were to do something and that was the only thing you could do. Now, that being said, the big impact of the science, where is the most exciting science that you can do held? And I think it might be out here. I mean, there have certainly been cases of observed compact objects where you have 20 solar mass black holes and above, 20, 30. And there are certain reasons to expect that low metallicity star formation will preferentially form higher mass black holes. So those are awful. I'm sorry. I know this is not a, but they have more mass. They'll tidally disrupt in band.
Black hole, probably the star will not get tidally disrupted. It will just get swallowed by the black hole.
It depends on the...
I guess the only way you get disruption is if you're in the upper right-hand corner of my plot and you have a near-extremal Kerr black hole.
Exactly. So I mean, you just have to pump it up. And so in that case, we're going back to the question, okay, what do you think the black hole spin should be? And do you believe these black holes and these binaries would be very, very highly spinning?
If you believe collapse star models, it's not perhaps not implausible to believe stars are rapidly rotating at low metallicity. So... Christian is writing, but sometimes, I mean, we're in a situation now where our lack of knowledge is large and our need for knowledge is great. So you can do a case where it's going to be absorbed promptly by the black hole, but I bet I could write down the answer for that without having to have a simulation. So if we need a simulation, we need a simulation where it doesn't get disrupted, because that's the one where you can get the new science out. So don't do the simulations where you're not going to get new science out. I mean, yes, it's perhaps implausible, and it might be hard to get that high spin. I mean, I don't know if Harold can give you initial data with sufficiently high spin. But it might be worth going after. I don't know if it would be worth going after given the amount of computational effort that would need to go into it.
I guess what I'm going after is, if you leave us alone, mm-hmm. we'll go after the thing that we consider the sexiest, even when it might not be the most physically relevant, right?
Well, if you don't want to be sexy, if you want to put on your suit and tie and go to work tomorrow and do what the LSE wants you to do, this is what we're going to tell you, right? 5, 10, 15, and then vary the equation of state as a tunable parameter and vary all the spins and give us a library, and that would be the first stage probably of what Matter Ninja is going to want, right? Now, that's very important, and if we're going to do high precision science with the sources that are most likely, then that is what you should do. There should be a Matter Ninja, and it should explore the space thoroughly and give us a way of quantifying how we can extract information about the equation of state about. For example, for double neutron stars, their corresponding case, you tell us about all these oscillation modes. You tell us how it depends on neutrino transport. I mean, that's a lot of work. This thing is probably not going to be that much work, right? Except for the fact that it's long. But we don't know, right? There's a good reason to believe they're high-mass compact objects, probably Kern binaries. If you have a binary neutron star with a high-mass black hole, what happens? Right? That's a quick, fun problem. I don't have to do it. What do you want to do with your life? Right? You tell me. what do you guys want to do, right? I mean, look at this, right? Where's my conclusion slide, right? I mean, it's not like there's a small number of things that are important. There's a large number of things to work on. Pretty much anything you guys can work on is important. You can do things that we know we need, 100%. And you can work on doing them right, because they're going to depend on things like neutrino transport with disk, if you want to get out the Matt's talk. I don't want to give Matt's talk again. You can do crazier things. You can work on EM signals. You can work on ejecta. Anything you guys do is important, and we need anything. We just need more stuff. The LIGO people, as a matter of preference, tend to be pretty orderly, and so I would say that if you ask them, they're going to ask for Matter Ninja, because they know how to deal with that, and that will contribute to a lot of science, to be able to do controlled experiments, that sort of thing. But that's not to say that a lot of other fun things aren't interesting, too.
I was going to say, I mean, there are physically realistic ranges of spins and things, right, like, as well. I mean, you're probably not going to have a zero spinning black hole, and you're probably not going to have a 0.999 black hole.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if there's been much looked at this in terms of taking stellar progenitors. I mean, that's an uncertain thing is that the angle of momentum in the stellar progenitors before they collapse is extremely uncertain. But has that been looked into in terms of not just mass distribution of black holes from pop synthesis, but spin distribution?
Chris does have some stuff. I think his most recent paper assumed a delta function birth at, I don't remember the number. But I certainly agree that there needs to be a lot more done in this respect. By comparison, for example, the way LIGO assumes things now, it assumes spins are isotropically oriented and are equally likely to have 0, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, uniform distribution spin magnitude, which biases you towards, depends if you believe in uniform in volume or uniform in magnitude. There's a bias there. It's not a squared. So it would be nice to know the answer to that. And there are people in this room who could tell us something about how supernova birth spins could work. And I could, and Chris, and, or you could work on how the spins evolve through mass transfer. And that would be really helpful. We have ideas. For example, the spin magnitude distribution, you don't tend to tilt the spins as much, so it's predominantly controlled by the kicks and the birth spins, and then there's some little accretion depending on how much you believe about hypercritical common envelope accretion to change the black hole mass. So most work just assumes that the spins magnitudes don't change and they get tilted up. Chris's work is the only one I know of where he's actually trying to tilt the spins by accretion.
I have a question to the speaker and to people who do binary neutron star simulations and experts on equation of state. So if you start with in binary neutron stars, if you start with the smallest possible neutron star masses, what are the chances that at the end, and if you use very stiff equation of state, what are the chances that at the end you will produce stable neutron stars after merger?
This is a question directed to people who do general equations of state, not necessarily at me. I mean, I can tell you a random answer, but the way we do it is we don't use an equation of state. We say you merge, and then there's a maximum mass, and you're over it or lower it, and it's just a number we pick. But, and I can tell you what a likely birth mass distribution is, but Jocelyn?
So this is, of course, going to be pretty much sensitive to the maximum mass of a stable neutron star.
So if you choose the most stiffest possible plausible equation of state and start with the smallest possible mass of neutron stars.
Well, okay, so what do you mean by the smallest possible mass of neutron stars?
This is
going to depend on how the neutron stars form, but if you look at the observations of binary neutron stars we have, they don't go much less than, say, 1.2 solar masses.
So if you start with 1.2?
Well, then the remnant is going to be basically 2.4 solar masses.
And so 1.2 is a gravitational mass, right? If you start with 1.2 gravitational mass?
Yeah, this is rough, but you want to go to the number of baryons and then add those together and then look at the, but I don't think you're going to make very many stable neutron stars from binary mergers.
But is it possible in principle if it was in the most optimistic case?
I couldn't say it's impossible, but it seems difficult or fine-tuned or something.
Okay, thanks.
If you did, what's the signature? Is that a spectacular event if you saw a merger and there was a stable compact object?
Well, you can get a pretty spectacular signature even with a remnant after the merger that is eventually going to collapse to a black hole. You get these temporarily stable hypermassive remnants, which have two interesting observational effects. One, they do produce some gravitational radiation, and the other is they tend to lead to large torus masses. So the details of how long-lived the hypermassive neutron star, though, is going to be very dependent on stuff like magnetic fields that we don't fully, or magnetic fields, neutrinos, you know, all this stuff. The frequency of oscillation of the hypermassive neutron star is fairly robust. The time until it collapses, the actual collapse is very sensitive to small instabilities, so it's hard to say for sure how observable that will be.
Finally, if I could, can you turn the question around and say, if you observe the merger of two 1.2s, could you prove that the maximum mass is less than 2.4?
Yeah. I don't know that there aren't a lot of numerical simulations that actually follow things to collapse to a stable neutron star. Most of them have an eventual collapse to a black hole. I'm guessing that what you would see is actually very similar. You'd have a hypermassive oscillating system for a while. Instead of collapsing to a black hole, it would just radiate away its energy and settle down to a stable configuration. I don't know if there's going to be a significant quantitative or even qualitative difference between the resulting gravitational wave. But it's not going to lose a lot of a lot of mass. I mean,
And
there is another component to it that if you have prompt collapse or delayed collapse, that also will be informing how high that maximum mass may be. Because if you are over that, when you expect a very prompt collapse.
Yeah, I just want to say that issue of whether you can lose enough mass in the merger to significantly reduce the mass of the neutron star. It'd be really interesting to see some of these magnetized calculations where people have done the neutrino transport and neutrino heating, because in the core collapse context, if you have a very rapidly spinning core that collapses to, and most familiar with it in terms of the accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf that's been studied by Adam Burrow's group, that's highly magnetized, so with, you know, where it collapses and has a magnetar field, the combined effects of neutrino heating and the centrifugal effects from the magnetic field can drive a lot of mass off of the central object. In that case, up to like a tenth of a solar mass integrated over the event. So I'm saying if you take a magnetized white dwarf and collapse it to a neutron star, and it has that field, so if these large fields are generated and they're able to produce a dipole component, and if you including the heating from neutrinos, I'm not saying anything. It's actually going to happen, but it's possible that you could lose a lot of mass and increase the stability of the object. This is why we need to combine the MHD and some of this microphysics of the heating.
So can I make a provocative question? So drawing from that, it seems like there are a lot of ways to decrease the mass gradually after it merges. So for people who do the simulations, is there any reason to expect a minimum electromagnetic signal? So if we have a source and we're going to point our telescopes at it forever, burn all telescope time on the globe to look at this thing, is there a minimum signal for collapse of a hypermassive remnant? I mean, if it's just marginally stable, I would expect it could collapse fairly smoothly. So I would think the answer would be zero. And if it's not zero, that would be interesting. But if it is zero, my concern would be, well, a lot of things can gradually decrease the mass, and we'll just move it across it. So as long as that decrease in mass is significant, that provides us a bound on our ability to resolve how accurately that maximum mass is.
Well, I can only just respond with a gut feeling. So I think there's not such a case. There is going to be a counterpart where it's going to be observable or not. Then we can put in the numbers and try to see how far must the source be in order for you to be able to detect it, how close it should be, rather, so for you to detect it. But, this is what we were discussing earlier. If you are talking about a binary neutron star, when they merge, you pump up the field to a large value. So you're starting with something that at least is magnetar or above with magnetic fields, and now it's contracting. And unless, there is a tension here that refers also to the previous question. The Newtonian simulations, when they do these binary neutron star mergers, the hypermassive neutron stars seem to hang around for a lot longer than any of the GR simulations of binary neutron stars. You believe whoever you want. I tend to believe that the GR simulations are the inclusion of the gravitational potential that is highly dynamical is prompting the time scale to be shorter. So now you have, if you believe that argument, then you have a star that has at least 10 to the 15 Gauss or a lot, or maybe a couple of orders of magnitude more, that is collapsing in about tenths of milliseconds. That, pumps up the magnetic field, pumps up the rotational rate. something interesting has to happen.
So would you say, to order of magnitude, that if I took the magnetic energy in the star and I assumed a significant fraction of it promptly escaped, that that would be a lower bound on the size of the counterpart, and that the minimum magnetic energy density would be, minimum field would be magnetar-sized field, 10 to the 15.
Right. And then there's the question, okay, what do you do with that tremendous amount of energy that you're dumping into its surrounding media? What is that going to do? This ties to Christian criticism earlier today. Well, I mean, it depends on the model and what is it that you believe will mediate the emission. But at least we can have some back-of-the-envelope estimates of how much energy you're dumping out.
So we're basically, as I understand it, just to make sure for myself, your opinion is, and I think I agree with you, that when it collapses, we'll probably be able to see it. We'll be able to see the initial conditions, and then there'll be some mass loss that we may not be able to see. So, Brian, you said this is about a tenth of a solar mass, tops. I mean, is there any way to bound that number in a useful way? I mean, if neutrino winds, I would imagine you'd be limited by neutrino luminosities. Kinetically, I mean, differential rotational support would seem like the simplest way of getting material off.
Just to say, my intuition with core collapse is where you have an object with a very high neutrino luminosity lasting for, you know, at that luminosity for like a second. So in these cases, it's not obvious that. So yeah, definitely a tenth of a solar mass would probably be the maximum, but could be more likely a, you know, hundredth of a solar mass or something.
Would there be an anti-correlation between? So for example, we'll also measure this, which is this delay. So we're going to know what went in. We're going to know how long this is, assuming that we see this event. I mean, the longer you wait, presumably the more matter you take off, and this is presumably goes to some power of a magnetic field. So if we know that length and the masses, could we say to order of magnitude how big that mass loss would be? I mean, what extra information do we need to know how big what that mass loss is?
I've done the magnetized. I mean, I don't think it's best addressed through the simple models I've done core collapse case. But if you know the B field and the neutrino luminosity. I mean, those are the two things that you would need to know. What's the dipole component of the magnetic field? How long does it survive as a hypermassive neutron star? And what's the neutrino luminosity? If you have those three things, you could estimate the mass loss.
But so basically, we have the equation of state, the structure of the object, which we'll have from simulations, because we'll know what the inputs are, and we'll have our best equation of state in a few years. So we'll know how hot it is.
Yeah, I mean, I would, if I had to guess, I mean, I would say that if that this is, you know, not a big enough effect that you're going to appreciably change the maximum mass, but it's something to keep in mind, I think.
So I think, guess, Chuck, maybe the answer is yes. That
so there will be an upper limit to the maximum mass of a neutron star.
Well, I think that's your job, right? If it depends on whether or not telescopes can see this, the EM counterpart, which is 10 to the 46 ergs or something, which you can only see in the local universe, I would think. But maybe, yeah. Oh, yeah, how long the delay is, but yeah. But if we're looking for the critical collapse, my hope would be that it would be unusually long. But yeah, if it's only a millisecond, then we're probably not going to do much.
Okay, I think this is a good point to stop, and we're going to retake these issues later in the afternoon. So just mull it over and bring with any questions or comments you may have. So we're going to break for lunch now. We start again at 3 p.m.